Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is that time again, true crime time. And once again, I am joined by Jen. How are you?
Hi, NT. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. You know, today's topic, trigger warning, might be disturbing. There will be talk of deviant sexual behavior, incest, other things like that. I just wanted to let everybody know kind of up front, especially with the whole incest thing. I don't want anybody to be triggered by it. But before I get to that, this part is safe, to some extent, I think, maybe. Okay. So last week we talked briefly about the Delphi thing. And I knew that I had got a tip from somebody, a reader, and somebody did. However, it was not the tip that I was looking for. And afterwards, I was kicking myself. And this person said, probably said, "Hey, I sent in this really interesting thing, and you didn't mention it." So I'm not going to tell the person's name because I didn't ask them if they did it. But they had something that's interesting, and I'm just going to read it. And I have no idea if it's true or anything like that. But it's just an interesting theory. And
okay. As cool. Always, let's hear it.
All right. Just says, "Hey, Auntie, thought you might find this interesting. A lot of local people suspect the youth ministry pastor at Delphi Methodist Church. Both girls' families were members of that church. I hear none of the forums are allowing talk of it, though. He has changed his look drastically since the murders. He's grown a beard that it looks like he dies. He lost weight, often wears glasses. He has two distinctive features from the new sketch, the long chin and the droopy left eye. Those two characteristics are specific enough for the police to go with the newest sketch. He was at the latest press conference, and both police officers stared to the left the entire time, sure looked as if they were staring in his direction. I've included some photos. The side-by-sides are all the same guy. Also included a picture of him baptizing in Deer Creek. You can see how he's changed his look over the last 2 years. He was clean-shaven at the time of the murders. Evidently, local people in Delphi have suspected him from the beginning, but locals are discouraged. A local mentioned him early on in the investigation on Facebook and was almost fired because it was reported to his boss, who was a parishioner at the church." And then the parentheses, "Sorry about this, because you got to tell me up front, but it says this was told to me third hand by a Delphi resident. It should probably remain on the download to protect the person he was talking about." He put up a YouTube video a few days after the last press conference and set his Instagram to private. Abby, who's Abby? Abby followed him on Instagram, which isn't unusual. They are on Reddit saying he had a Delphi Youth Ministry Snapchat account, and one of the girls followed that Snapchat. Hold on, they sent me another email. Hold on, forgot something interesting. Checking police scanner logs, police ran a check on license plates. I'm not going to say the name of the person. However, the police ran a check on the license plates of a car the same day the girls were found. And in this email, it tells me what kind of car. And it says the car was registered to a minister from a nearby town. I'm keeping out the specifics. And they also give the name of the person and the person's son. So interesting. Have you heard any of these theories before?
Yes, that is a theory that I am well aware of. I follow that theory along with three other persons of interest. Could you imagine if it was a youth pastor? A pastor would be someone that would actively help law enforcement and the family get through grief. You know, just think of everything that law enforcement has seen, and they talk about how the case keeps them up at night. And what if they went to this pastor and said a lot of things to him and tried to seek solace in him? Could you imagine if that guy did it? He's telling the police officers, you know, "Oh, it's okay," and he's comforting them. And then they go on to find out that he's the killer. That would make law enforcement really, really angry. You know, that would be the type of press conference you would see where someone's face turns red and they get upset. On the flip side of that, three other suspects, they have the same type of pattern as the pastor, the changing of appearance, people that would be in position to talk to law enforcement and also make them mad if law enforcement found out they did it. yes, I am very familiar with the pastor theory. I am not going to say either way if I think he did it. I'm going
to
stay out of it.
I have no idea if it's true, and I want to say that I have no idea if it's true.
Yeah, I get those same emails to my box, and I always tell people I'm not ignoring you, and I'm not being a jerk. It's just I will not drag those names out because these are average people. You know, they're not celebrities. These are people that have to wake up in the morning and they go to work, go to school. This could put people's, you know, careers in jeopardy if the information is wrong, you know, and it can be very defamatory.
Yes, so which is why the forums probably, you know, are not allowing specific names, I would imagine.
There is one Facebook group, if you are very interested in this, there is one Facebook group that is the Wild West. You need to go find it for yourself. And that theory is on there. There is supporting evidence. I would say it's 50-50. It's very good supporting evidence that makes you think. Very good opposing evidence that makes you think, much like the Michael Jackson people. You know, if you talk to one group, it sounds good. If you talk to the other group, that sounds good too. So you just need to vet that out. But it's definitely something to look into. I want everyone to look into Delphi and to look at every possible scenario. And if you can find something that I don't see or find something law enforcement doesn't see, give them the tip.
Yeah, so I'm imagining, though, that the law enforcement has probably, you know, investigated this person. It is interesting that they were at the press conference.
All three were at the press conference.
Oh, all three were at the press conference. Yeah.
All three.
Okay. And then this car that they called the license plate number for, and you're talking about somebody from the neighboring town. Is that one also of the people that you're watching?
There will be two vehicles that are going to say they were in the area and they have every right to be in the area because they are residents. And they're also going to say that their phones pinged off that specific cell phone tower by the bridge because they're residents and they belong. So when you're a resident, your vehicle being somewhere local and your phone being somewhere local, that's not going to be helpful to law enforcement. The third person does not have a vehicle. That's going to be the person that people subscribe to. He followed the creek in and out of the murder scene, but he too should have a cell phone that will be pinging off that tower.
Hmm.
With the pastor and with the other two, they're all in the same boat. They don't have priors that police can go up to them and talk to them about. None of them are on parole, so there's no type of parole violations that can allow police to drag them in and maybe squeeze them on something. They have no reason to approach any of these men. And if they approach too early, it's going to spook the guys. They're going to lawyer up, and then you've missed your opportunity to go up to them randomly and ask them questions. You know how it is. If you approach someone and they know that they need to be defensive, they'll shut down on you. And I think that's what Superintendent Carter is trying to avoid.
Okay, so when I read, this pastor, is this person the same? Because it's confusing to me when I read the emails. Is the pastor the same person who's from out of town that they checked the license plate on, or is it a different pastor?
Okay, the pastor should be local that I've seen spoken about, and he would have a reason to have a vehicle in the area. If they're talking about a different pastor, I don't know what that is.
Okay. It's probably the same. It's just the way that they worded it. So it's interesting. So, keeping up with it. And so I want to, you know, the person who sent me that, I don't want you to think that I blew you off. I got it confused with one that somebody else had sent. Okay. So today's main subject is the murder, the death. It's actually a question. Was David Carradine murdered?
You can do better than that. Come on. NC. This is the scandalous mystery death of Hollywood actor
David Carradine.
David Carradine.
You know, and this is, It's got a lot of good questions, and it's got a lot of good theories. And, you know, I'm not, I want to say that I'm not on the murder train right up front. However, I will say that there is a lot of shady stuff that I think was going on that people are keeping quiet. And so anyway, why don't you just lead us off with the introduction and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so basically with actor David Carradine, he was an American actor, and most people probably know him from Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill. He did those films, and from the Kung Fu TV series, so he was widely popular. The question about his death is going to be, is it actually the cause of death that is printed on his death certificate, or is it going to be a murder cover-up? And while Inti says that we're not exactly on the murder train, today we're going to board it, you know, and we're going to go around and just look at all these different theories and see what happens. But he was in Bangkok, Thailand, and he was working on this low-budget film. Normally he did, you know, higher quality films, right? But this one was low budget. He was off in Bangkok, and he had only been there for 3 days when this tragedy occurred. And the tragedy being that on June 3rd of 2009, this 72-year-old, 6-foot-tall actor is discovered in a small closet of his 5-star luxury hotel suite. He is completely naked. He is hanging from the clothing bar that is in the closet. He has a rope tied around his neck, and the rope is also tied to his genitals. It looks like some type of pulley system. Okay, so authorities, you know, Thai authorities come in, they look at it, and at first glance, they think, okay, well, it's a suicide. You know, clearly he's hung himself. It is what it is. They lead people to believe that that's exactly what they're going to put down on the death certificate, and the family starts screaming. You have the family, the associates, and they're all saying, no, 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 this is not going to happen like this. So the Thai authorities were reluctant, but, you know, they're forced at this point to look further into it. So they start looking at his background, and the friends are all saying, look, he had a lot of film gigs lined up. This guy was at the height of his career. He just purchased a new car. He's happy in his marriage. He's happy, period, because we go on to find out he has a hobby that keeps him happy 24/7. So the authorities say, okay, well, there's no suicide note left behind, and we're going to be pressed to find an explanation as to why this guy is dead. So they start looking at his background, and they start looking at his different behavior, and then it all, to them, kind of starts lining up. They pair it with a crime scene and their autopsy, and they say our most plausible theory is going to be that it's going to be death by fatal erotic asphyxiation. And as far as the Thai authorities are, you know, thinking about things, that's where they wanted to leave it. And then in comes the family and the American media.
Yeah, you know, and this is where things get interesting. And I want to make, I want to say one thing. He wasn't completely naked. He was wearing, what was he? Oh, fishnets and a wig.
Was he really? You know, yeah. When you go to look at these pictures, there's so many fakes out there, but then you read about the ones that, you know, Ebner saw. And so I tend to think that his, you know, those are going to be the best, you know, I trusted that opinion, but I didn't know about the fishnets.
Yeah. That's so it was a fishnets and wig. And this is, the rest of it, which you said is correct. I mean, it's, you know, him hanging from a bar in the closet. And then there's also another picture that shows red women's lingerie on a nearby bed.
I was going to ask you what that red piece of cloth was on the bed, because you know, yeah, that spooked me. I was like, is that a calling card, or is, was that left behind?
Well, you see, here's the thing. So transvestite role playing, which is suggested by the presence of the women's undergarments, is often part of autoerotic stimulation. That's kind of part of the thing. And what, you know, there's also some pictures that came from the autopsy and things like that, which is kind of crazy. But there's a filmmaker, and his name is Robert Dunlap, and he has no relation or interaction to David Carradine at all. But he said he made a documentary about people who engage in deviant sex practices. And he thinks, he kind of asked the same question that the family members asked, and we're going to go over the each individual family members, but they questioned the conclusion of the cause of death, because they wondered how the actor could have bound his own wrists behind him, and saying that the evidence suggests foul play. And so this filmmaker said, who is an expert on this, said it didn't look like a solo act at all. In order to have an orgasm, his hands would have had to be free. And then he referenced the presence of the red lingerie, and he said, you don't dress just for yourself. Usually there's some sort of show and someone else is involved. It probably went horribly bad and they left.
I tend to agree with that because, you know, his ex-wife, that Jill Jensen, she said that, you know, she divorced him over this whole deviant sexual behavior that he was so fixated on. But she said, I don't buy the fact that he died in that room alone because he loved to perform for people. The only way that he could be satisfied was if someone else was in the room. And like you said, he could dress up for them. You know, he could basically get off with them.
Yeah, I think it was Gail who said, so Gail is his third wife. And then there's the fourth wife, Marina, who really fully involved herself in this. And you have to determine whether or not her involvement and her just diving head on to this was more of a concern or more of wanting to sell books. But Gail, who died about a year later after this happened in 2009, I remember reading something where she said that he would think of a scenario and he would build up to the scenario for a week or so. And then he would go to the hardware store and sex stores and things like that to get ready for this performance that he had in his mind. She said that he was able to tie himself. However, she never really clarified if he was able to tie himself up with his hands behind his back. I find that very, very difficult to believe.
Okay, well, a lot of people would, but then we think about the Rebecca and the Shaq and I situation where they said that there's no way that Rebecca could have bound her hands behind her back. And then we found out through demonstration that she could. Just something to think about.
And Gail, the third wife, said that he liked to tie himself up at home and he would ride horses bareback wearing nothing but a Speedo. So, you know, the guy definitely had his things that he liked. So he had only been in Bangkok a short time. I mean, this is the kind of place that, you know, he was probably in heaven the whole time he was there. But both Gail, the third wife, and the fourth wife, Marina, said that he definitely, you know, sexually deviant behavior and, but then you start talking about, okay, but was he murdered?
Okay, well, he goes to Thailand to do a low budget film, and we both know he could have got other projects that were better paying. So he must have wanted to go to Thailand. Like you said, it's a paradise. It's a corrupt place, in my opinion. Probably in a lot of people's opinion, you can get anything you want there, you know, any type of sexual fantasy granted to you. So he goes there. Maybe he goes to the cowboy district and he hires up, you know, one of these ladyboys. And like you said, brings them back to his room. You said he was wearing female garments.
Well, he was wearing fishnets and a wig.
And then there's female type garments on his bed. That screams. Yeah, that screams the lady boy, I've been to the cowboy district to me. You know, maybe the person was transgender or it could have just been a female straight outright. Maybe he brings someone like that back to the room.
I think that was probably a female. I think that he only really was with women. I haven't seen anything where he was with other people. I mean, other sexes. So I think he was pretty much, I mean, and you know, Anderson pretty much told everything that he ever did. So I imagine that if there was ever other men involved or something like that, that she would have brought that up.
I believe you, because I don't know that part. I don't know if he swung both ways, but if Anderson says, you know,
well, she just never brought it up. So I'm just saying that if she never brought it up in a book where she literally talks about everything, that I think that it was probably just a woman. But she had said that in the book that she wrote, the David Carradine, The Eye of My Tornado, she said, there were certain things on there that I thought, well, you can't have marks around your neck by just doing an autoerotic or sexual asphyxiation. maybe someone would want to do that for money. David always carried a lot of cash, and he always wore expensive watches. You can attract unwanted elements. Given what David was into, Thailand, Bangkok's a sex heaven, and I think he indulged in something went incredibly wrong. And David was always happy when he worked, she said, and I believe he was targeted, whether they went up to his room unsolicited or he got bored and went into town and brought somebody up. I don't believe he was by himself. Now, I don't think that somebody went up to his room unsolicited. I think that perhaps he went and got somebody, or somebody was called up or something of that nature.
I do too, because he was left alone that night. You know, he was supposed to have people that were paid to look after him, and it was an assistant. And we go on to find that out in the wrongful death suit that his wife, the widow, goes on to file. But it said that his assistant and the people that he was working with on the film, they go off and leave him that night. They go to dinner, and they said they tried to reach him by phone. He did not take their phone call, but he does end up calling them back an hour later. And they're like, look, it's too late. We're at dinner. You're on your own. So at that point, we have to surmise that he left the hotel room, and then he went off and found what he needed and perhaps brought them back. You know, that could be where the person comes in.
Yeah, you know, and police originally said, okay, well, it's not a robbery because, you know, he still, but he didn't have a watch, a really expensive watch that he wore. And my theory about that is that when he tied, or whoever tied his hands behind him, that the watch would have got in the way. And so they would have taken off the watch, and perhaps it was just laying there on a dresser or a nightstand or something like that. And the person that was in the room just said, I'm grabbing this watch.
Yeah, if they were in there and something terribly went wrong, if you look at how the system that he had going on was rigged up, the pulley system attached to his genitals, he could have been beheaded. He could have been castrated. There was a lot of room for error. So say that she went on to kill him, whether she meant to or not, she probably did clean him out. And this guy was known to carry a lot of money, like cash money on him. How would police know if it was a robbery or not? They had never been in his room previously. I doubt that David Carradine told the police or the hotel when he checked in, hey, I've got all this money on me.
Yeah, you know, this is how much exactly I have on me. So if I do get murdered later, this is, you know. Now, he had said before he left something like, if I ever see you again or something like that, which originally, I guess, had led to the determination it was perhaps suicide. Now, the Carradine family attorney is Mark Garagos, the name, you know, that everybody knows. And he took it to some kind of crazy step where he said that, I can't even say it because it's so ridiculous, but that he was killed by secret kung fu assassins because he was going to reveal that David Carradine was going to reveal some kind of secret kung fu sect, and so that's why they killed him. I don't, you know, even know what to say about that. And I think what he was trying to do, perhaps, is to equate it to Bruce Lee, who also died under kind of mysterious circumstances. And for a long time, there was the theory that Bruce Lee was killed by triads. You know,
I read that theory and I was like you. I was like, oh my gosh, where do I begin on this? Do I laugh? Do I cry? It's a crazy theory, and it does drag in Bruce Lee. It goes on to drag in like Uma Thurman, just all these different scenarios of, it's like throwing spaghetti to the wall and whatever the person thinks will stick. That's sort of what they did.
Yeah.
I don't know what to think about that.
So, yeah, you know, but it is interesting because Bruce Lee, when he died, I mean, he was, cause he was married, and, much the same as David Carradine was married, but Bruce Lee ended up, dying at, Betty Ting's house, who administered the drug that Bruce Lee died from. So then the theory has always been, oh, well, you know, perhaps she did that for the triads or something like that. I think what it was he was on a number of medications, and the medication that she gave him did not, you know, interact well. And that's, you know, what I think killed Bruce Lee.
Yeah, a fatal interaction. I'm on board with that.
Anyway, so the Anderson, she was really open and she talked a lot in this the book that she wrote about their sex life. And I just thought that that was, you know, kind of something that you weren't really expecting. But I think she said, well, you know, we got the sex thing and the death. So, but she says that the reason that she thinks that there was something untoward or that perhaps he was murdered was that she got an email from what she said is a total stranger. She said, this total stranger who tracked me from the internet sent me an article about this other man in Thailand who died under mysterious circumstances, just like David. The physicality was very much how David looked. I'm thinking, could this be a serial killer? Because of the similar circumstances. They look alike. They're both noted people. The other dead man was a member of the Apollo navigation team with NASA. He was a former official at NASA. And it was shocking to me to see the similarity in the face alone. Then a mutual friend of ours who lives in Toronto said he talked to David a few weeks before he went to Thailand, and David made some flip comment, yeah, if I ever get back. I thought David was murdered for theft, but then somebody said there wasn't anything missing, money and everything accounted for, but, like I said, there's still no accounting for the watch that he had that was really, really expensive. Now, I believe this is something that I think is really important to note. Because she engaged in this kind of behavior with him, it seems to be not on a daily basis, but definitely a couple of times a week, where she would know the circumstances and she would know what he liked to do. And she would also know when she says something like, the autopsy pictures showed a clear mark around his throat, which you don't get with this kind of an act. So when she says something like that, I have to believe her. Just because of the fact that, it's, you know, maybe somebody else would get a mark, but she has been doing it with this guy for years and years and years. She also said,
I don't know what that means about the clear mark. I mean, if he was hanging in a closet or he was hanging anywhere for hours, it's going to give you that deep ligature cut mark. You know, all the blood is going to start to pool right there.
True. Very true. She also said that because the files closed in Thailand, that there's something that nobody will ever see. And she says that there's surveillance footage, which nobody ever got to see in the United States. Only the Thai police got to see.
And yeah. So the surveillance would solve it. Literally, the surveillance video would tell the tell, and investigative journalists have been trying to get their hands on that. And the Thai government will not give it up. They said, we have seen it and that needs to be good enough for you. Go away. And on top of that, that hotel room that he died in, or the suite rather, it does not even exist. You know, they have some type of customary practice, whether it's Buddhist or something else, to where if someone dies in one of their rooms, they completely refurbish that room. They take it off the blueprint of the hotel. So the room number is missing. The room in its entirety is missing. And it's just known now as the vanishing room. It's not a conspiracy. There's no entrance to it. There's no exit. It's just gone.
And also something about the wrongful death. So his fifth wife and widow at the time, Annie Bierman, she filed a lawsuit against the production company alleging breach of contract and wrongful death. You know, kind of a long shot kind of thing. Anderson said that, you know, when she was talking about the book, she said that she started it long before the couple divorced in 2001. But maybe she couldn't get a deal until, you know, he died in 2009.
Of course.
Yeah. And it's interesting because she said this. She goes, when he passed away under the circumstances he did, he was handing the baton to me to correct people's thinking and explain why. I didn't want the last memory with the public to be just that. There's got to be an understanding now of him as a human being, not a celluloid fantasy with faults and his own demons, and for people to understand why he was like this. But honestly, if somebody says to you, David Carradine, the first thing you're going to think about is, oh, he died, you know, in a closet in Thailand. you know, I don't think that anybody's perception is going to be changed. I think that she can say this, but then she wrote a book that was basically just talking about it. I mean, she says that her book's a love story.
Her book is no love story. Her book is called Opportunity Knocking, and I'm going to cash in on it. This guy had a proclivity for the most sexual, dark, erotic, bondage fantasies that you could ever imagine. And I think the guy would have been just fine with everyone having that be his legacy. You know, he's dead now. He was doing this while he was alive, and his closest friends and family members and associates, they all knew about it. So if he didn't care what they thought and he loved those people, then I don't really think he cared about what the public opinion would be if this all came out.
Yeah. She says that the reason that they got divorced after 4 years of marriage was because of incest. And she never identifies the family member, not even the gender. She just says that the relationship was with a younger relative and spanned both of his marriages to her and to the previous wife, Gail. Now, what's interesting in that is that Gail is the one who introduced them to get, you know, to, she introduced them and said, oh, you know, you guys would be good together or something, but if, why would you introduce somebody if you knew that they were having an incestuous relationship with somebody and say, I think this would be a good match for you?
Way that you would introduce someone to someone else is if you thought they had a lot in common. I mean, obviously she knew what Carradine was into, and if she's introducing him to another woman, she would have to assume that other woman is going to be on board with everything that he is bringing to the table. And this guy is colorful. He's bringing a lot.
Yeah. She said that, I'll tell you this. I mean, she's been in a show. She was on the NBC show called Unsolved. She was the co-lead of that thing, but she kept him sober, during the entire time they were together, and acted as his publicist and manager, and she's actually the one who introduced him to Quentin Tarantino, which is how he got cast in Kill Bill, which kind of gave him a second career. And she said, I wanted to talk about the... Okay, so she says that she tried erotic asphyxiation with him, and then felt obligated to talk about it in her book, because of her concern over increased interest among teens in the so-called choking game. Then she said, where was this? I had never experienced anything like that, and I was really excited about my relationship, and that was new territory for me. I didn't know that was his meat and potatoes. For me, it was just a phase, and I just tried it because it was something new. I was already hooked in the relationship. She goes, but at some point I said, oh, this is really his preference. I've really got a problem on my hand. But that's not why she divorced. She says that she divorced him because of the incest. And, you know, here's where she kind of loses everybody, is that she starts talking about how she knew things about him and stuff. And she starts quoting psychics and stuff, who she had people do readings on David Carradine and John Edward, the clairvoyant, and he kind of helped her unravel what really happened in Thailand, and that she had a self-exorcism with olive oil to cleanse the house of bad vibes.
Okay, no offense to her, but she sounds batshit, you know what. I mean, the whole thing is like, you know, she's coming from a point of view of someone that has always been in his life, that was always making money from his life. She had an active role in almost everything he did. And clearly with the book, she's still making money. I can't take her too seriously. I tend to think it's one-sided, like a one-sided narrative. And she just tells us what she wants us to know and things that would make her not look bad.
Yeah, you know, she talks about when they got divorced, the file was supposed to be to go under seal, which means nobody was supposed to see it. However, her lawyers accidentally didn't file something under seal, and by the time it was discovered, It was too late. And so then there was 4 pages of a declaration.
We love that.
Yeah. And she said, she starts talking about it. But she doesn't ever say, like, this was the, you know, the reason, at least in this. It seems to me that the reason was, when I'm just glancing at some of this, is that he didn't have any money. Their house was foreclosed on. He couldn't get a loan. So the money came from her mom. And, so she ponied up 40 grand and it was her name on the thing, but nobody paid. And so the mom's credit got trashed. But she says, I'm just trying to see here. Also the people of questionable character he liked to have in his life. It was the continuation of abhorrent and deviant sexual behavior, which was potentially deadly. So again, when she says potentially deadly, I'm guessing that she's talking about asphyxiation. So even though this is from 2003, you know, she understood that there was consequences of, you know, that kind of, sexual game. She goes, let's see.
Yeah, when I read her statements, that was the only thing that I selected out of everything she said, was the one statement about where she said this sexual deviant behavior is going to lead to death. And that was one of her main reasons for bailing out of the marriage.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, she's probably right about that because, you know, look at what happened to him, either by his own hands or by someone else being in the room.
And then she also goes on to say, his deviant behavior includes an incestuous relationship with a very close family member, which permeated our marriage. Now, I will say this. There are 2 celebrities, well, 3, but it's not going to be his half-brother. But his half-brother is Robert Carradine, who, you know, I think is most famous for being in Revenge of the Nerds. But he has 2 nieces who are both extremely famous. One is Ever Carradine, and the other is Martha Plimpton. So, you know, you think about that, and you go, but knowing Martha, as I do, I've never asked her that. However, knowing Martha, she would 100% talk about it if something like that had happened to her. She is completely open and honest about everything. I don't think it was ever either. But, you know, this is something that she is putting in a declaration. And like I said, she says, a very close family member, which permeated our marriage. This is to his admission and to the admission of the person involved. My pleas for him to get counseling in regards to this matter were ignored, and he wanted no part in the healing process the other person needed in order to get closure. And then this is something else that was interesting. And again, I wonder if it's, you know, she talks about him being violent and things, but she said he continued to denigrate me in public, touching me inappropriately, and wanted me to flash the public with my top off, which was brought to the attention of one of our counselors. I was also suffering and still do from severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And she says in her book, rather than, and I don't think she says it here, but that she was also subject to incest when she was growing up. So this whole incestuous thing was very damaging to her. And I don't know if she's referring to that as her post-traumatic stress disorder, or if she's referring to just being abused by him. Let's see.
I believe if she went on to hook up with him, that he displayed this behavior while they were dating, you know, as they were getting engaged, as they were getting married. All of this is not anything I could see him suppressing, because they were sleeping together, obviously, before they got married. He was likely asking for all these different fantasies. I'm not blaming her. She is probably a victim of him in some capacity.
Yeah.
But she knew all this stuff about him. I tend to think that the prior stuff that happened to her with the incest might be the reason why she brings up incest now. You know, you have no victim stepping forward claiming that they're the Carradine incest victim. And like you said, half of his family, they're famous. They have no reason not to pen a book or to come out and say, yeah, it happened, but none of them do.
Yeah. So I'm not even sure if that is true. There was another line that she wrote in here, which I think just is a perfect line that she wrote in her declaration, and it says, "Further damage to me by David was made when he and his gal pal and Scientologist Annie Bierman made calls to Mark Quinn, my agent and ex-agent, to David, blah, blah, blah." But just the fact that and this gal pal, first of all, she's using the term gal pal, and second of all, but she did call Annie Bierman out for being a Scientologist, and this is who, you know, David ended up marrying. This was his widow.
Yes.
So that just kind of adds a whole nother layer to this whole thing. Because then
that's
I'm wondering,
rabbit hole.
Did David get involved in Scientology? And, you know, when you go to Scientology and they hook you up to the e-meter, then all of a sudden, you know, you start telling all your secrets. And David's got a ton of secrets. But even if he didn't join Scientology and do this, Annie, you know, when she's doing her auditing sessions, is going to start talking about David and all the things that he's into. And then, you know, the next thing you know, somebody has got some things on David, you know, some blackmail options.
So, I mean, anytime you sit down with somebody, it doesn't matter what org or person it is. If you let somebody audit you and you give them that type of material, you could be blackmailed. Sure.
Let's see. She talked about that they went to a screening and she says that he supposedly lives with Bierman, who was not present at the event. When I gave him a cordial hug, hello, he quickly covertly fondled my breast. And then I called my date over to introduce him and then he changed. And then she said, you know, I legally changed my name because I don't want to be connected in any way with the negativity he carries with him and his name or with him. And then she also blames him for ruining her career and stuff. And again, she's not really talking about the fact that incest is what destroyed their marriage, as she does when she's selling the book. And the fact that she's selling the book and she's trying to sell a bill of goods and saying, okay, that you know, that perhaps he, you know, all these games and the incest and all that. I mean, that's obviously going to sell books.
Yeah, she needed something that was more salacious than what he was already into. Because what tops all of these hardcore, dark bondage fantasies? Well, the only thing that could top it would be underage incest. So that was probably her trying to one-up him. That's just my opinion. I don't believe her on that part.
And also, I need to correct something because I saw this, is that a couple things, is Jensen did introduce Anderson to David Carradine. However, they were introduced while David was still married to Gail, and then it appears that David and Anderson started having an affair while he was married to Gail, and then subsequently Gail divorced. In an interview, Gail said this to TMZ. She said that, and this is what I mentioned earlier, but she doesn't specify. She said that the actor was able to tie himself up without assistance and did so at home. And then, quote, he spent days planning a different feature. He would go to a hardware store and buy the stuff.
And we've seen this because, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey, it shows that Christian Grey going to the hardware store, he's buying all the different type of pulleys and stuff that you would need to carry out those fantasies. So when you see something like that, you know, that is what she's talking about in her story. Carradine was one of those type of men.
Yes. Now, something that she mentioned in a different interview that I hadn't mentioned is, first of all, because the incest thing came out in that declaration, he said that it was malicious. However, there was something that was very interesting that kind of, if you're thinking about an incest kind of thought, this is an interview she gave, and she said, this is when they were still in a court battle, and people say all kinds of things. She claimed that he once begged her to become pregnant by both his brother and son. She said, quote, David went to his brother and then to his son because he wanted to have a child with me and needed a sperm donor. I vetoed the idea. Having a son father his own sibling was a little too off the wall for me. That is a little bit off the wall.
It is. But you know what? I might actually believe her on that because of his age.
No, he was, I mean, yeah, I totally, but what I'm doing is I'm just referring it to, you know, so if he was thinking, okay, well, it's okay if my brother or my son is the, you know, the father of my wife's child, I'm okay with that. You know,
yeah, that's crazy. That definitely goes to the state of mind, and he clearly was crazy. But why did he need it? Why did he want a kid?
Well, I think
look at everything he's into. Yeah. I mean, what's that about?
Yeah. So I think that I'm going back to the filmmaker who made the documentary and just his experience with everything, where he says, you know, that it doesn't look like a solo act at all. And that, you know, even if what he says about in order to have an orgasm, his hands would have had to be free. But again, we've determined that he did tie his hands, but we don't know if he usually tied them in front of his body rather than behind. I do find it interesting that, you know, why would you get dressed up in the fishnets and the wig if there was nobody else there? I think that somebody was there. I don't think that he was murdered. I think that the situation went a little bit too far. Perhaps he was not, he didn't know about the pulley, or, you know, because it's not something that he, you know, normally set up. He's in a hotel closet or whatever it was. And, you know, so
it was thin. I think that the rope was just too thin. It was the kind of rope that could cut you. I mean, cut you bad if you were not careful with it. And perhaps that's all they had available. But they tied it too tight and strung them up too much, and they played too hard. And then you have the hotel that will not release the surveillance video to anyone. All they will say is that no one came and no one went while he was in the room. So we'll never know if one of the, you know, Thai prostitutes, you know, let herself in and out. The fact they won't give that up is weird. They did no DNA testing at the site at all. The whole crime scene was just trampled over. It was a mess. The chief medical examiner was out of town. So you have this high profile actor die, and the chief medical examiner is nowhere to be found. She comes back and she sees the mess that the medical examiner that was in charge left for her. And she was like, oh shit. Like, literally, she said that. And she said the whole thing was botched.
Yeah. So I honestly, my conclusion is I don't think that he was murdered, but I think that there was somebody there. And just because I have a tough time just with the circumstances and the items that were present and everything, thinking that, you know, he was alone. And like you said, they didn't do the DNA testing. I think they just said, this is kind of bizarre. Let's just get this out of, you know, out of here and closed. And, you know,
did you see what they do in Thailand? It's not like they just have CSI come in and, you know, they keep the crime scene, you know, very pristine or anything. They have these freelance people that come in and they're called body snatchers. And the hotel basically just calls them up. They take the body to the morgue, and it could be on a flatbed truck. It could be in the back of a pickup truck. You don't need any type of credentials to do it. It's just freelance people like you and I that are available, and they take a body to the morgue. And that is so horrible when you're thinking about trying to keep a crime scene together and keeping evidence the way that you need it to be.
It is. Okay, so that wraps up another week of True Crime. You can see, Jen's Patreon is Dead and Documented. She's on Twitter as Mascara and Mace. And you can go there and find out all the details and where to go and links and such like that. So Jen, I appreciate it. And next week we will have another, probably Hollywood murder, cause I seem to be into those right now. And knowing us, probably another episode, installment of Delphi too.
Yeah, it's pretty safe to say. But thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye.